chapter of the book of Romans. Romans, the 15th chapter. It's good to be with you. I've looked forward to this meeting for some time. I love your preacher. And I'm so glad to be able to be with him and be with the group that, from everything that I've heard, have treated him really well, and he really enjoys his work here with you. So that's good enough recommendation for me. But it's good to be with you, and I'm looking forward to the study this week. In the fourth verse of chapter 15 in the book of Romans, it says, "And whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope." Is my mic on? Is my mic on? Okay, good. I just saw somebody going like this, and I thought maybe I needed to readjust my mic. The things written aforetime are written for our instruction. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's a valuable thing for us to do from time to time, to have character studies of biblical characters, because these things were written not just so that we could have a record of what happened. Anytime you have a historical record that is taking place, you're having things that you have to leave out, and you have things that you have to include. There is no such thing as a complete historical record. Things have to be picked and chosen. And the Holy Spirit has picked and chosen what to include for us. But the reason is, as we see here in chapter 15 and verse 4, is so that we, through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, might have hope. Some of the characters that we can read about in Old and New Testament that I hope to work with this week, hopefully can teach us some lessons that can help us be better Christians here in our day and our time. So we're going to begin this morning talking about Joseph, and through the week talk about some characters that you've probably heard about, a few that may not be quite as noteworthy to some of you. But I hope that through our study we might be able to learn some lessons that could make us better people here in our time as we learn from the successes and the mistakes of some of the people in the Scriptures. This morning, my lesson is entitled, "The Success of Joseph." And one of the things that made me think of this particular lesson was some of the excuses that I get for people not coming to church. I live in Houston, Texas, preach for the Kleinwood Church of Christ there in Houston. And a lot of times we have occasion for people to come from different places around, and we hear that they're in town, and there comes the time in which we come and visit them, and some people who just never get started coming to church. And it's interesting to see some of the excuses that some of those people offer for not getting around to coming to church after being in a place for a reasonable length of time. One of those excuses sometimes is that, well, it's just not like it was back home. I've visited some places, and, you know, it's just not like it is back in Amarillo. It's just not like it is back in Lubbock. Not like it is in College Station. Not like it is in Dallas. And we just never have felt comfortable here in this new place worshiping God. Now, that's a lousy excuse, as you can tell right off. But I've heard that from people. Just not like it is back home. I've talked to some people who say, you know, God's people have mistreated me, and because of that, I'm just not going to go to church. Now, I don't want to excuse anybody mistreating anybody else, but it doesn't sound like a very good excuse to me for somebody to say people have mistreated me and they have done wrong, so therefore I'm going to do wrong by not serving God. Does that sound like a good excuse to you? But I've heard people actually make that same particular kind of argument. And, you know, you also hear people, as they make kinds of excuses, say it's not like it was back home. It's not like it, you know, it's just God's people have mistreated me. And I've actually heard some people say over the course of time that God really hadn't done anything for me. And that's one of the most disturbing excuses that I hear some people give, is when they get to the point where they've given up on God, where they look at their lives and they see some of the tragedies that come upon human beings as we live in this world that is subject to vanity because of human sinfulness, and somehow think that, well, because this has happened to me, and because this has happened to me, and this has happened to me, and I really didn't expect it, that God has just abandoned me, and therefore I'm going to abandon Him. It's almost like taking the advice that Job's wife gave him to curse God and die. But I've known people who've actually basically done that in their spiritual lives. So these three excuses are ones that I've heard throughout my life as a gospel preacher, as people try to make excuses for not being faithful, especially in a new situation. It's made me think, though, that Joseph is the kind of fellow who could have made every one of those excuses. We see him beginning in the 37th chapter of the book of Genesis, being a fellow who was the favorite son of his father, Jacob. In fact, Joseph had been given a coat of many colors by his father to show how blessed he was and how much he appreciated him. We see him being in a situation in which his brothers, because of his favored situation, become jealous of him. And because of that jealousy, they look at him in every particular way as someone who is simply a dreamer, as someone who thinks much more highly of himself than he ought to think, especially since he's younger in age than many of them. On a couple of occasions, he has dreams. On one dream, he and his brothers are out harvesting. And as they harvest, their sheaves are all standing up, and eventually all of the sheaves bow down before his sheaf. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to be able to figure out what this means, is that he thought that everybody was going to, all of his brothers were going to bow down to him. He has another dream in which he dreams that the sun, moon, and stars are all in their heavens, and eventually you see the sun, the moon, and all of the rest of the stars bowing down before his star. As he tells these dreams, it grows even greater resentment on the part of his brothers, and we see them finally, when they have the occasion, when they have him alone, they make their determination that they're going to kill him. In fact, if it hadn't have been for Reuben deciding that he's going to try to redeem himself with his father and throwing Joseph in a pit instead, hoping to rescue him later on, that he probably would have been killed. But while Reuben is away, Judah comes up with this great idea. He said, there's some Ishmaelite and Midianite traders. Let's sell him. Now let me tell you, I think an awful lot of my brother Kyle, and I never really ever considered killing him. I did hog tie him and hang him on a doorknob one time, but except for that, I don't think I've ever really came close to killing him. But it's a good thing no one had ever suggested that I sell him, because there'd have been times I'd have sold him for a song. But that's my failing rather than his. I was 8 years older, and sometimes a little brother who's 8 years younger can be a little bit aggravating to a fellow who thinks he's full grown at 13 years of age. But here they sell him. And they sell him, and they tell the father that actually an animal must have killed him, because they take a kid and put its blood on this coat of many colors and bring it before Jacob and make Jacob think that his favorite son has been killed. And he's taken down to Egypt and he's sold. He's sold to a man named Potiphar, and he rises to the top of Potiphar's house as a trusted official. And yet, in that situation, we see him being the subject of sexual harassment on the part of Potiphar's wife, who constantly wants him to lie with her. And in fact, when he doesn't, she even lies about the fact that he came and tried to take advantage of her. And in doing so, gets him put into prison. For doing the right thing, we see him having a bad consequence. But while in prison, we see him again rising to the top, just like cream does in milk. He rose to the top again and becomes a trusted official there in the prison. While in the prison, we see him coming in contact with a couple of Pharaoh's servants, the baker and the butler. And both of them have dreams that he has occasion to interpret. And they both turn out exactly differently, but exactly like Joseph had prophesied that they would happen. And all he asks of the butler is, when you're restored to your position, I want you to tell Pharaoh about my unjust position here in prison. But the butler forgot about it. It's not until Pharaoh has a dream that no one can interpret that we see the butler remembering his obligation. And he comes before Pharaoh and tells him about Joseph and the interpretation that he gave for him and the baker in prison, and how that the butler was restored to his position and the baker was hanged, both consistently with what Joseph had said. So he's brought before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh tells him his dreams. He's sleeping, and out of the Nile come seven fat cows. Beautiful cows. Wonderful cows. But after them come cows that he said you wouldn't even see in Egypt because of their poorness. And yet, what happens is the poor cows wind up eating the fat cows. And it's a disturbing kind of dream. You can imagine a pastoral scene. Up from the river come these fat cows. Up from the river come these skinny cows. And before you know it, these cows they just consume the others. I don't know. I've never seen a cow eat another cow, much less a skinny cow eat a fat cow. That would be a disturbing dream. He then goes on and he dreams about there being nice harvest scenes. And there are seven fat ears of grain. And then all of a sudden come up seven poor ears of grain. And before you know it, you see the poor grain consuming the fat ears of grain. Again, I've never seen grain eat grain, but here we see it happening. And that was disturbing. And he woke up and he was disturbed by it, and no one could interpret his dream until Joseph is brought in. And he lets him understand that what this means is from God, and the reason that he's confirmed it with two dreams is the fact that you are going to have 7 years of plenty. And then after the 7 years of plenty, there's going to be 7 years of famine. And after the 7 years of famine, you are going to, it's going to be worse than you can imagine, so that people won't even remember the fat years that happened before that. What you need to do is appoint someone who is wise, who can take and store up grain for the lean years. And during that particular time, he can make provision for it. And God is letting Pharaoh know what will happen in the near future. Pharaoh then appoints Joseph to be in the position, to be the official who takes care of everything and has everyone bow the knee to Joseph. And it's under those circumstances that, as you recall, he's reintroduced to his brothers, and eventually he allows his brothers and his father to come down into the land of Egypt where they can be saved during this terrible famine. Every one of the things that we have talked about that are excuses that are brought up for not serving God is something that Joseph could have said. Down in Egypt, was it like it was back home? Certainly not. The favored son of a desert sheik there who's living in the land of Canaan, who's accumulated flocks and herds and is wealthy, even though a nomad in a land of cities and a land of wealth. He's a wealthy man that lives there off the land. And yet he goes down into Egypt, and in Egypt it's just not the same. He's at the bottom of the list, at the bottom of the pile. He's a slave. And then after a slave, he becomes a prisoner. All of these things are just not like it was back home. He could have made the excuse that, you know, God's people haven't done me right. Because can you imagine a situation where your brothers would take you and they would sell you, and then lie about the fact that you had been killed so that the father didn't even come looking for him? Have you ever thought about that? I expect that he probably thought, boy, I've been sold down here, but Daddy's going to come looking for me. You know, and boy, those brothers of mine are going to get in trouble when Daddy comes down here and finds me, because he's not going to abandon me. What he doesn't know is the fact that his dad doesn't come looking for him because he thinks he's dead. I don't know what Joseph would have thought, but here you can imagine him thinking, look at what my brothers have done. My father's forgotten about me. Everything is terrible. All the excuses that people use could have been used by Joseph. And, you know, he could also have used the other excuse that, you know, God hadn't done anything for me. Here I tried to serve God. I've tried to be a faithful son. I've tried to do what God would have me to do. God's given me dreams that I told to my father and to my mother and to my brothers. And yet, of all of these things, in spite of the fact that I've tried to serve God, I've become a slave. I tried to do the right thing. And even in trying to do the right thing, I wind up being accused of doing the wrong thing and put in prison unjustly. And then after being put in prison unjustly, I finally am in a situation where I can be released because someone who has connections with Pharaoh is the one whose dream I have interpreted positively. And all I've asked is that he just tell Pharaoh about my position and he forgets about me. I've known people who on less discouragement have given up on God. But the wonderful thing I see about Joseph is the fact that in spite of all of those things, we see him becoming a spiritual success, because in everything we see Joseph doing what he ought to do rather than what we see many people doing today, and what we see many people doing today without the same excuses Joseph could have used. What do we see Joseph doing in the midst of the discouragement that had to be at least a part of his life as he was in Egypt? The first thing that we see is that we see him trying to be the best he can be in every situation. He tries to be the best son. In fact, we're introduced in chapter 37 about how that when his brothers are somehow misbehaving, he brings to his father in chapter 37, verse 2, a bad report back about them. He's looking out for his father's interest and not just for his brother's misbehavior. We see him being, when he becomes a slave, he doesn't just mope around about the fact that here he's born free and now as a slave. He becomes a trusted slave in the house of Potiphar. We see him even when he's put in prison unjustly. He doesn't just stay there and mope. We see him becoming the best kind of prisoner he can be, so that he's put in charge of other prisoners. And when we see him finally working for Pharaoh, he works for Pharaoh, as the story goes on to tell us, that he, even before the famine is over, everything in Egypt belongs to Pharaoh because he has consolidated Pharaoh's power. He tried to be the best he could be in every situation in life. We live in a country in which victimhood somehow has been exalted to where everyone wants to think, well, now because this has happened to me, I just really am not able to function like I need to. Or, you know, I could really be a good Christian if this happened, or if this happened, or if somebody hadn't done this to me, or if this hadn't happened, or if this hadn't happened. Well, you know, none of those are very effective. What it boils down to is, what are you doing, and what are you doing here? What are you doing now? Because let me tell you, in terms of your spiritual life, it's not about here, and it's not about now. It's about what you're going to do in order to be the best you can be able to serve God. And that's what we see Joseph doing in this situation as described here in the book of Genesis. The second thing that we see, I think, in him is not only did he try to be the best he could be, he's the kind of person who does the right thing. One of the things that I think expresses that in about as good a situation as I can imagine is when we read about his temptation by Potiphar's wife in chapter 39. You remember there that because he was a good-looking young man, he was brought down to Egypt when he was 17 years old and has matured. So now he's probably in a situation of, you know, full manhood. He's a good-looking young man. And Pharaoh's wife looks upon him with lust. And it tells us in verse 7, it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here my master doesn't concern himself with anything in the house, and he's put all that he owns in my charge." First of all, it wouldn't be fair for me to violate the trust that my master has placed in me. We live in a day and time in which people don't seem to value the trust that they have often been given. But we need to be the kind of people who don't betray trust. Do you realize, young people, that if you are the kind of person who tells the truth, who does what you're supposed to do, who follows orders, who doesn't steal, who can pass the drug tests that are given by jobs, do you realize you're going to be a success in whatever field that you want to be? In the past, it took many other qualities. Now, all it does is just taking somebody who knows how to do what they're told to do and not betray their master. Not betray their employer by not doing the kind of work that they're supposed to do. And here, when he's being tempted, we see him saying, "Wouldn't be fair for me to betray the trust that my master has given me." We see him also going on to say, "There's no one greater in this house than I," in verse 9. "And he has withheld nothing from me except you because you're his wife." The second thing he says is, "This isn't right. I am not married. You're married to Mr. Potiphar. And you have a right to Mr. Potiphar, and he has a right to you. I'm not married. I don't have a right to anybody at this particular time." He hoped to get married one day, I expect, and he does get married. But he says, "Then I'll have a right to that person, and they'll have a right to me. But because you're married to Mr. Potiphar, I don't have a right to you." Do you remember in the fourth chapter of the book of Philippians, as it talks about the things that we're to think about and concentrate on, it emphasizes that rightness is something that ought to be characteristic of the life of the child of God. It tells us that finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there's any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. Are we interested in doing right because it's right? Or we do right because, well, I don't want to face the consequences of doing wrong? You know, I'm afraid that unless we do right because we love what is right and have learned to love what's right, we're really not operating consistently with what God would have us to do as outlined in Scripture. The greatest thing, though, that really makes me love Joseph in this story, though, is what he says at the last part of verse 9. And that is, he says, how then could I do this great evil and sin against God? Let me tell you a secret. It's not a secret, it's just something you may not know. Most of the people in the ancient world were not monotheists. A monotheist is a person that believes in one God. Most people were polytheists. They believed that there were many different gods. But polytheism is not a very functional term because even though people who live in societies where they believe there are many gods, they usually don't make any effort to serve all the gods that they even know. Henotheism, which in some ways means, you know, comes from henea, the word for one in Greek. Most people in the ancient world were polytheists that were also henotheists, which meant that they believed that every god had its jurisdiction. There was a god of the mountains. There was a god of the trees. There was a god of the forest. There was a god of the river. There was a god of all of these things. And therefore, if you had dealings with those particular areas in nature, then you needed to give proper respect to the god who had control of those particular areas. Now, before we begin to think too strangely about that, I want you to recognize that Jonah was a henotheist. When God tells him to do something that he doesn't want to do, he decides he's going to go to Tarshish, which is probably what we call Spain. Why do you think he decided to do that? Because he thought, if he got to Spain, God would know what he was doing. Do you see? And God had to teach him a little lesson to let him know that, let me tell you, you can get to Spain, you can get in the belly of the sea monster, you can go to the very bottom of the ocean, and I still know what's going on, and I still am the one who is going to be the one that you obey. One way or another. You see? During the days of the kings, there's on one occasion in which the Syrians are concerned about the Israelites being defeating them on a regular basis under Ahab. And they say, well, you know, the problem is because our God is a God of the plains and their God is a God of the mountains. And we're fighting them in the mountains. Let's fight them in the plains where our God is stronger. You see, most people in the ancient world were henotheists. If you left Canaan, most people would have thought, then I need to make sure that I adapt and worship the gods of Egypt. You know, one of the things that you have to love about Joseph, even though he's a young man, is he realizes that how could I do this great evil and sin against God? He has an understanding that many people didn't have in his day and time, and that is that God knows what goes on in Egypt. God knows what goes on in my heart. God knows what goes on in the bedroom of Potiphar's house. And you know, we need to understand that too. Now again, boy, those simple people can't believe how foolish and stupid they were. Not believing in that you could get out of God's jurisdiction. Have you ever known anybody that went off to college and forgot about God? You know why? Because they thought they left God in Amarillo or Houston, and somehow God wasn't in Lubbock, and God wasn't in College Station, and God wasn't in Austin. It's henotheism. You ever known anybody that dressed modestly when they were at home, but they go to Padre Island and somehow you don't need to wear clothes down there? Because after all, God's not down in Padre Island, is He? That's henotheism. It's the same kind of foolishness that most people thought in Joseph's day, and Joseph doesn't think that way. He realizes, like in that old song we used to sing, there's an all-seeing eye watching you. And we need to understand that too. So not only was he the best that he could be, but he determined that in any situation, what he was going to do was he was going to do the right thing. And one other thing I think is important about Joseph is the fact that he determined that he was going to give God time to work. Oh, that's hard to do, isn't it? In our day and time, as Americans living in the 21st century, it's easy for us to want what we want and to want what we want now. It amazes people around the world how Americans love things that are instant. That you can mix them with water, maybe pop them in a microwave and have something like that. It doesn't have the same appeal to many people around the world because they're not as interested in things happening as fast as they ought to. I had an Italian friend with me one time who was visiting in the States, and we went by and picked up some of my laundry at a drive-in laundry and asked him if he wanted a Starbucks. And I said, "Do you want to go through the drive-in or do you want to go inside?" And he goes, "Drive-in? You mean you can drive in at a Starbucks? You mean just, you don't have time to get out and have a cup of coffee. You just drive by, put your money up there, and they give you the coffee? You Americans," he just shook his head. How you want what you want and you want it now. Boy, that's true of us though, isn't it? Don't have time, man. Stop by all the drive-in places and get everything that I need and then circle back home. Somehow we think that God's that way. Like a Coke machine. You can put your coins in or try to feed you. I hate those things where you try to feed a dollar bill through. It's got to be brand new, fresh, run off the press for most of them to take them. But you, if it's wrinkled, if it's got a corner on it or anything, try to run that thing through to be able to get you soda water. And here you wind up having a situation in which people think God's that way. That here, if I get whatever I want it now, and I want God to be able to do that. And somehow, if God doesn't have my same timetable, then there's something wrong with God. We need to understand that one of the beautiful things about Joseph is he gave God time to work. And God took him, who was sold a slave, and made him to be one of the leaders in Egypt. And he continued to live the kind of life that let God work. It tells us in the 41st chapter of the book of Genesis, in verse 45, that when Joseph was exalted to his position, he was given the name by Pharaoh Zaphnath-Paneah. And he gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, a priest of On, as his wife. And Joseph went forth over the land of Egypt. It's interesting to me that Zaphnath-Paneah is a name that is given here, but it is insignificant as far as the story of the Scriptures are concerned. And the reason is because we find Joseph not only giving God time to work during his own lifetime, but giving God time to work beyond his lifetime. I often thought it was strange in the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews, when it was talking about Joseph, it mentioned in verse 22, he says, "By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones." I remember when I was younger, I thought, well, I'll tell you, I'll be switched if I couldn't come up with a better example of the faith of Joseph than that. But I was wrong. Because there may be no better indication of the faith of Joseph to allow God to let time, to give God time to work things out than to allow God to work things out even beyond His lifetime. In the 50th chapter of the book of Genesis, when He's talking to His brothers, He said, I'll tell you, whatever you do, don't bury me here. And it's interesting to me, in the book of Exodus, when we see the children of Israel going out of the land of Egypt, we see them in chapter 13, verse 19, it says, And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones with you from here. And in the last few verses of the book of Joshua, it's interesting to me to notice how that those bones that they had taken with them and had with them for over 40 years in the wilderness, it says in verse 32 of the last chapter of the book of Joshua, it says, Now they buried the bones of Joseph, which the sons of Israel brought up from Egypt at Shechem, in the piece of ground which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of money, and they became the inheritance of Joseph's son. Right in the borderline between where the tribe of Manasseh and the tribe of Ephraim, the two tribes descended from Joseph, was where Joseph's bones were buried. It's interesting for me. I kind of like mummies. I've loved to go to museums where you can see a mummy. And it's strange to see this desiccated human being who's been unwrapped and yet has died many, many years ago. And I've been to a Ramses exhibit because they've uncovered where Ramses II was buried. The Tut exhibit, I've seen that in Cairo. It's amazing to be able to see all of those things. But you never see one for Zaphnath-Paneah. You know why? Because he gave God time to work. And he realized it may not be this year, it may not be the next year, it may not be the next 20 years, it may not be the next 100 years. But let me tell you, one day God's going to do what He said He would do. And when He does, I don't want my bones to be here left in Egypt. I want them to be in the heart of the country where my descendants will live. Don't make excuses about why you don't serve God. Because let me tell you, Joseph was a success in spite of the fact that there were all kinds of excuses he could have used. But in everything, we see him trying to do, be the best that he can be. Having a strong determination that whatever he did was going to be right and it was going to be godly and it was going to keep God in mind because he knew God could see whatever he did. And he gave God time to work. My hope and prayer for all of us as we go through some of these studies over the course of the next few days is that we can have the same attitude as we try to live our lives. Be the best we can. Do the things that are right. And give God time to work things out. And God will ultimately work things out consistent with His will. Thank you very much. Appreciate your attention.